Hi, you're listening to Steve Downs. This is a recording of my talk from the recent NoTIPS conference. It's being recorded directly from the Illuminate platform on which the conference took place. Hope you enjoy it.
In case you may not have got his newsletter, he produces all daily, and it's a great newsletter. I highly recommend it. I've been a member for a very long time, and I'm looking forward to having his presentation here on our NoTIPS conference, and we thank him a great deal for presenting for this, our first conference. And I'll turn it over to you, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much, and it is indeed a pleasure to be here. I'd like to welcome everybody here who's online with me. Didn't really get a chance to meet you, but I certainly hope to hear from you during the course of the talk. I do want to encourage anyone who has a comment or a question anywhere along the line to raise your hand. It's a little tiny hand, and my eyes are old, so it's a bit hard to see, but I'll be watching for it, and I'll certainly stop my flow of talking so that you can kick in with your comments or your questions. They give me a lot of freedom to present on basically whatever I wanted, which is in some cases a good idea, in some cases a bad idea, because what that means is you very often end up getting a presentation of what's on the top of my mind at the time of the presentation. As the moderators now know, I tend to write my presentations at the last minute. The reason for that is that things change, and things change very quickly on the internet. For this presentation, part of what's been on my mind recently is some work by Scott Wilson on the concept of the e-learning framework, and this is a new initiative in the field of e-learning. It's mostly right now a set of proposals, but surrounding that is discussion around the concept of how online learning should be organized, whether in a centralized system or a distributed system, and if it's a distributed system, what that system should look like. And so we'll be talking about that. That'll be the beginning part of the talk. And that sort of leads me into a theme which has been a familiar one of mine over the last few months, talking about how many of the distributed technologies that already exist on the World Wide Web can, and in my opinion, should be used in order to support online learning. I'm going to run through a wide array of them, although I did notice in the tools there's a touring thing, so if I can make that work, that'll be a bit of an experiment for me, because I don't use Illuminate a whole lot. We'll be able to take a look at some of these things. It's kind of a scrambly day for me because in this very vein, we just launched, there's a large group of us just launching at this very moment, in fact, an online site called Our Media, which is a site which will allow people to publish their own audio and visual media for the world to see. So that's also in my mind, and I'm thinking about that a little bit. That uses one of the systems that I'll be talking about a little bit later on called Drupal. But we'll see how this goes. So we'll take it from there. How's that sound for everybody so far? I guess you can give me a check mark or a smile or something. Okay, one smile, two smiles. Check marks. I don't really know the distinction between check marks and smiles, but... okay, it sounds, seems like it meets with the approval of most people. I am reading your text comments as they come up. If you notice me laughing halfway through a sentence for no reason, it's probably because I saw one of your remarks in the text and I'm reacting to it. I am trying to read and talk at the same time. I'd be trying to chew gum too, but let's not push it. So, okay, I'm hoping you can all see this next slide. In other words, I'm hoping I've hit the correct button. This is a very simplified representation, of course, but the idea here is to sketch in very broad strokes two major approaches to the design of online environments. And I've given them the names centralized and distributed. I suppose other people have given them these names as well. And as you can see from the diagram, there's two very different pictures of online environments. And the centralized, basically what you have is a big box. And inside the big box are all the little boxes. The little boxes represent resources. They represent applications. They represent the discussion list or the chat area, things like that. Centralized system is very much what you might expect to see from a learning management system, where you as the student or as the instructor would log into the system, and then the system supports all of the little boxes. Everything's all in the one place. We contrast that with a distributed system. If you look at the diagram of the distributed system, you don't see the big box. What you see is a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of little boxes, and relations drawn between the little boxes. The idea here is that there's no central location for the services or the content, but rather these services and these content are distributed. They're in different locations. They're managed by different people. And people handle their own things, their own logon, for example. Now, it used to be, a long time ago, the case that people didn't even know how internet services were going to be provided. In fact, it was back in the days before the internet really became popular. And the model for accessing online content was a centralized system. And some of you who are as old as I am will remember things like CompuServe or Prodigy or Genie, these large online bulletin board systems. And you would log into them, you'd phone up, right, and you'd log into them. Remember CompuServe, it was $6 an hour to use CompuServe. And the idea was that you'd log into this system, and that would be your online access. Everything would be available through CompuServe. The last major service, indeed, to operate this way was America Online. America Online was one of these big box models of online services. But eventually, we ended up with a distributed system, which is the World Wide Web as we know it today, where instead of one thing that you log on to, the resources are distributed around the world with thousands and thousands of different websites. And access is distributed as well. You access the internet through your own internet service provider, and there are thousands of different internet service providers. So the internet itself has adopted the distributed model. In contrast to the centralized model. Now, on the web today, we sort of see this written in smaller text. We see on the web today a combination of both centralized and distributed services. Probably the most well-known centralized service online is Yahoo. I assume most of you have been to Yahoo, right? At least once or twice. I go to Yahoo because I like to play backgammon. It's a good place to play backgammon. But Yahoo's a big box, isn't it? Yes, Yahoo. you go to Yahoo, you log on with your Yahoo ID. Mine is DataMouse 2001. And then you access their games or the Yahoo groups or the search engine or their launch music service and a whole bunch of other things. And what Yahoo's trying to do is make itself, if you will, the destination resort of the internet. Everybody goes there. Everybody has a good time. But there are various other services on the internet that are very distributed. How many of you have used instant messaging, like ICQ or AOL Instant Messenger? Give me a hand or a check or a smile or, the most of you, right? These are services that are, I got a bell too. Oh, and I got a hand raised. That's probably why I got the bell. These are services that are distributed. I'm going to give up the mic, and whoever's hand is raised, I guess, can speak. Do I make them speak? I don't know.
No, just so that you know, Stephen, when you give up the mic, then they can just click the talk button. Roberta, if you have a question, go ahead.
Okay, that's no problem, Roberta. It was a good dry run. See, I've done presentations on Illuminate before, but most places are smart enough not to give me moderator permissions. So I don't have all these extra controls and commands. All I do is talk and somebody else flips the slides forward. But they've given me all kinds of toys here, and actually I'm kind of relishing the power. Like, I can make a big circle on my slide. It's so cool. I like doing that. Although it serves no real purpose, but I'm sure it's useful. And we trust you. Thank you for the trust. So anyhow, I'm just laughing at Sue's comment there. The power. Anyhow, what we see in the world of online learning, and I imagine most of you have seen this yourselves, is to a large degree the centralized model. The learning management system or the campus portal, these are the classic examples of centralized system, aren't they? Where all the services, the chat, the discussion, the content, the grading, the tests, everything is located in that one system. As Julia says quite correctly, WebCT, Blackboard, these are the big box models offering services, the university services like classes or lessons online. But now, there's been discussion of these centralized services, and in my view, and I think not only in my view, these centralized environments are, as the slide says, static, inflexible, and expensive. They're static and inflexible because, really, you're using one system to accommodate all people. Now, of course, you can build in personalization into a system like that. A lot of these systems do allow a certain amount of personalization. But as you get more and more people, more and more diverse people, it gets harder and harder for a centralized system to offer diversity. It's like, for example, suppose you had some students from Iceland and you wanted to work in Icelandic. Well, this would turn out to be a fairly difficult challenge in a centralized system. I picked Icelandic because there was a big dispute about whether the Windows operating system should support Icelandic or not. I don't know how hard it is to support WebCT or Icelandic and WebCT or Blackboard, but I can hazard a guess. Although, for all I know, there's an Icelandic module out there. But the thing is, with a large centralized service, you reach an upper limit in your capacity to provide diverse environments for diverse people. Because each time you get a new level of diversity, it means basically coding another instance of your service, another version of your content, different translations or different design for all your pages, all your text. Another problem is that these centralized systems tend to be expensive. Now, we all know about the costs of the... Julia's making a very good example here. UVic, all logins must be from uvic.ca addresses. Yeah, that's the sort of thing that happens. The reason, now these systems are also expensive. Part of the reason why they're expensive now is they become very large, complex pieces of software. And this one piece of software is trying to serve all the needs of all the people. Every feature you could possibly imagine has to be put into this one system because there's only one system. Another way they become expensive is in terms of bandwidth requirements. And you might think, well, it shouldn't be more expensive if you have 100 people accessing individually than if you put them all in one system, it's just 100 times the same amount. But the thing is, that's not how it works, because people's access goes up and then goes down. And what happens is, in a large centralized system, if you look at the patterns of access, you get peaks and valleys. Now, this happens at home as well, but the peaks aren't very big, right? But in a centralized system, you find everybody is accessing at 4:30 p.m. And that is the bandwidth that you have to provide for that system. And the thing is, you have to basically provide that bandwidth all the time, because you don't necessarily know when the peaks are going to be. Now, there are complex arrangements that you can make with your service provider for bandwidth management, peak management, but nonetheless, peak demand dramatically increases the cost of bandwidth. It's more expensive to host a large centralized service than it is to take the same service and distribute it over 100 different locations. So as I mentioned before, the World Wide Web is an example of a distributed environment, which means that resources and access are not centralized, but they're scattered around the world. There's three major things there. The resources, web pages, for example, or animations, or videos, or whatever, are in a network, on a network of web servers. And these web servers, of course, are connected to each other. Access through your internet service provider is also distributed. You don't call up California to log on to the internet. You call up your local internet service provider. And then, of course, users, you with your web browser, you are also distributed. The tool that you access the internet with is located on your computer. The web browser sits on your computer and not in some centralized service. That didn't used to be the case. Web browsers are a recent invention. When I first started accessing the internet, I would open up a plain console and then use what was called Telnet, and then all the services would be provided from the server side, not from the client side, that is, not from my own computer. But the thing is, a big issue with a distributed environment is integration, because now instead of one big, nice, consistent system that always works the same for all the people, we've got, you know, say, 100 people with 100 different operating systems, 100, you know, some people might be using Apple, some people might be using Linux, some people might be using Internet Explorer, some people might be using Firefox. Hopefully they're using Firefox, but not everybody is yet. Some people even use Opera. Some people, the old diehards, use a text-only browser called Lynx. So it makes it difficult, and it makes it an issue. How do you get 100 different systems working together? Well, this is the domain of integration. And integration describes how to go about making one person's computer system work with another person's computer system. There's two major views of integration. They've been trying this largely from Scott Wilson and some work on the CETUS website. Like I said, I was reading Scott recently, so this is what's in my mind. But I like this account of this. One way is service-oriented, and then the other way is client-oriented, which sounds just like a bunch of jargon. But what that means is, in one way, it's like you speak the same sort of language. That would be the service-oriented way. You and the remote site speak the same language. In other words, like a website uses HTML in order to represent its contents, and your browser knows how to read HTML. So the use of this common language allows your web browser and the remote website to communicate. Now, it doesn't matter what kind of software your browser and the web server are, as long as they speak the same language. So this is a service-oriented, or sometimes called a standards-oriented approach, where the interface between the two programs is defined. That's why we say there are application program interfaces. The other way is what's called client-oriented. That's where the web server has a particular type of content, and now it's up to you, the client, to get the right software in order to run their application. And that happens in cases where we use plugins, for example, on our own system. For example, if you are browsing the web and you wanted to see some animation, some animated content, then you would need to install a copy of the Flash Player. or this system, Illuminate, for example. I couldn't just log on to this system with my web browser because all I would get is a blank screen. I had to download the Java Runtime Engine, and then I had to use the Java Runtime Engine in order to download the Illuminate software. So I've got all this software now running on my computer specifically to allow me to interact with you on this system here. Now, as you can imagine, and as the slide says, this can get complex in a hurry. Oh, Java Web Start for Internet Explorer, but Macintosh has the JNLP already in the OS. Oh, wasn't that handy? It'd be nice if that happened in Windows, but, well, we all know about Microsoft. Ask Bill. I'm not a big fan of Java myself, but at least it's working here. It doesn't always work, but it seems to be going okay at the moment. And that's the weakness of the client-oriented approach, right, is you have to have the software, and the software has to be specific to your machine, and yet it has to be specific to the application as well, which means you're very often dealing with different versions and different types of software. Yeah, this has happened to me, is it Zeus or Zeus? I've had computers where every time I tried to access something, it would download the runtime engine again. It used to be that way for QuickTime too. I had more copies of QuickTime on my system. We are off in the complexities discussion, we certainly are. You'll find I am very easily distracted. This is a good thing. Okay, so how do we approach integration? Well, I'm drawing from a particular paper here that just came out recently in First Monday. There's been a lot of discussion of this, and this is one representation of these design principles, but I think they're good principles. First of all, you have to concentrate on practical uses that are likely to become everyday routines. The design of a lot of these systems is what's sometimes called design by exception or preemptive coding, sometimes it's called, where you look at the sort of things that might go wrong and then you build all of that into your program. But really, what you're designing for is the sort of things that people are going to do on a regular basis and on a routine basis, looking at a website, looking at an image, those sort of basics. And then the development of this new technology needs to be based on these core operations. Again, get the important stuff done and done well before, as they say, working on the bells and whistles. Make sure that your web server can deliver web pages before worrying about whether it can also walk your dog. And then finally, real experiences and real networks must be continuously taken into account. I have very often commented, not always in jest, that the people who designed learning object metadata never actually had to use learning object metadata. They just designed it, and they didn't think about what was involved in writing it and what was involved in parsing it. And I say that from the perspective of somebody who has authored software both to create learning object metadata and even more to the case, or more to the point, parse and understand learning object metadata. It wasn't designed with that in mind, in my view. And so, the author's core principles are my core principles: simplicity and realism. Go for the simplest possible solution. Go for the most practical possible solution. And these are the principles that lead me not only to distributed networking, but also to, service-oriented approaches to networks. I like simple languages that all types of software can easily implement. I like, for example, something called RSS. Now, it's not possible to read the URL you have displayed. Is it important? Yes, it's pretty small, isn't it? It was much bigger on my computer. No, it's not important. I'll type out the address of these slides. They're available on my website, or if you get my newsletter, I just posted a link to them in my newsletter. And so to follow up that URL, just go to the slides and you can follow it up there. Or it should be possible to... Oh, no, you can't. See, simple operations. I wanted to cut and paste so I could expand to this. Can't do it. Very... Oh, good, I got another reader. Just for one link. Trust me, you can't enlarge, Stephen. You see, it's such a basic operation. Yeah, it's in First Monday, and it's the most recent First Monday. It is a good article. You do want to have a look at it. It might not directly relate to online learning, but it does relate to the design principles and principles that you should have in mind if you are designing online learning. Oh, very good. Thanks, Randy. Okay, how are we doing for time? 8:59, about halfway through. And 40 slides to go. All right, just kidding. Like I said, I've been reading Scott Wilson. This picture, again, was much bigger on my screen. But you want to get the idea here. Notice how different this picture looks from your typical learning management system. You can copy and paste this using keyboard shortcut keys. That'd be Control-C and Control-V, I assume, Rebby. That's what it is in every other program. But if they follow good design principles, that's what they do here. Yes, good. Now, the box in the center that says Future VLE, some people have been calling that PLE for Portable Learning Environment. I like PLE for Personal Learning Environment. The idea here is that, oh, they're still asking for a password at our meeting, are they? I love people who multitask. Okay, it hasn't officially launched yet. You'll have to wait. Sorry. it's the timing of a launch. It's being timed to coincide with an article in the New York Times. And because I'm giving this talk here now, I jumped the gun a little bit in my newsletter. But, well, I'm sure people will come back to it, I hope. Okay. Oh, you're leaving us, Carol? Okay. Bye. Okay. Oh, good. Thanks, Nancy. Openmedia.org gives some info for now. I'm surprised they're still asking for a password, although, of course, it didn't occur to me that they would have left that alone. Anyhow, looking at our distributed design model, the idea here is that the VLE, or as I've been saying, the PLE, is personally based. It's yours. It's like your web browser. It's like your computer. It's you. And then you don't access one large big box out there on the internet. You access a whole, oh, very nice. Somebody made it bigger. A whole range of services. And there's been there's a bunch of these things listed here. Live Journal, for example, which is a blogging site. Learn Direct, which is a course site, portfolio site. Personal hosting for a website. Flickr, which is a place where you can store and view images. Bolton Institute, which is portfolios. 43 Things, which is a social networking site. And these, all of these different sites provide different services. And the idea is you access the services that you want from the internet according to the way that you want to use them. So there's no single big box, this is the course, this is what you will take. Rather, your act of online learning consists of accessing resources from a large number of places around the web. How does that sound so far? Did everybody follow that so far? Looking for hands, smiles, check marks, little flashy things. Oh, somebody raised a hand, but then they dropped it. Yeah, I would do that too. I wonder what happens if I raise my hand when I'm on the air. Okay, and now... Oh, and then I click it again, it goes away. Flashy things, yes. Print's still not readable on the slide, no. But the print's not important here so much, although if you look at the little words, you see the arrows between the sort of clouds and the feature of ELE? You see the little words? Like if you look at Learn Direct, that's the one right on the very left-hand side, that would be West. You see a bunch of little arrows, right? And the little words, I can read them somehow. They say portfolio transcript, course info, FOF, Adam, RNS. All of these little words, they are talking about the language or the standard that's used by your computer system and the remote system in order to communicate with each other. And that's how this distributed system works. Your system speaks a bunch of these different languages, and all of these remote systems, no matter how they've been developed, they also read these same sorts of languages. Okay, I mentioned the e-learning framework, and what the e-learning framework is an attempt to identify the set of common services that would be used to support online learning. Now, I say online learning in a distributed environment. It's not clear that these are intended to be deployed in a distributed environment, although they should be deployed in a distributed environment. This is the first set of services, learning and teaching services. And I know it's hard to read there. I'm sorry, I really should have thought this through and made bigger text. But you can see things like sequencing, assessment, marking, grading, competency. And from where I sit, not everybody needs all of these services. But what's important here is the capacity for either an instructor or a student or perhaps an educational institution to pick and choose the services that they will use. So rather than buy a system, a big box like a learning management system that supports all of these things, you just choose which ones that you're going to use. And the other thing is, you don't have to host these services yourself. You can actually use a service that is provided by another institution. This is going to result in some possibilities that just simply did not exist in the world of the learning management system. For example, suppose you have an English class online, and suppose you have some sort of activity management system that you want to use, and instead of hosting it in your own university, you decide that you're going to access a remote service. Okay, so far so good. Looks and feels just like it was on your own campus. But the thing is, you're accessing it from this remote service. At the same time, other English classes in other universities might also be accessing the same service. So by accessing this service, you might also be giving your students an opportunity to communicate with and collaborate with people who are taking similar courses in distant universities. This goes way beyond what is possible or even conceivable in a big box learning management system. I might add, it goes way beyond a lot of what's out there on the web now. If you're in Yahoo, if you're a Yahoo login, you can't participate in the Google group. You have to log off Yahoo, go over to Google, log into Google, and now you're at Google, but you're not your Yahoo identity anymore, you're your Google identity. There's still a ways to go. Now that's just the first set of services. Here's another set. And by now you should be sort of like, oh my goodness. Look at them. Authentication, authorization, DRM, rules, rating, annotation, terminology, alert, user preferences, forum, resolver, etc. What a mess. And none of these have been built yet. That's not completely true. Some things are built, some things are partially built, some things interact, some things don't interact. But, I look at this, and I look at these e-learning organizations, an ELF e-learning framework. It's a joint project between Industry Canada and JISC in Britain and several other agencies. Is it ADL in the States? I believe so, yes. And they're looking at this, and it's like they're looking at this as though we have to build things from scratch. I look at this. Sorry, just took a sip of coffee there. What's this tricky to do with a microphone? Thank you. I look at this, and I say, well, a lot of these services already exist, are already out there on the internet, and all we need to do as designers or users of educational technology is tap into them, like chat, for example. All kinds of chat rooms and chat services, or voice. I use a program called Skype, which is a beautiful internet telephony system. It's free, and it works beautifully, and I don't need to in that one specifically for learning. Someone said DRM is Greek to me. That stands for Digital Rights Management, which is a quagmire, to say the least, but basically is a mechanism for recording the usage rights of a resource, in this case a learning resource, and in some cases preventing unauthorized use of that resource, for example, by preventing access through lockdown or by encryption or things like that. Now, if you sit down, and the other thing with this list, too, this list is going to change. I sit down and I look at this list and I see authentication in one box and DRM in another box, and I'm sitting and I sort of scratch my head because these two are very closely related. They're not separate things. And there's some things like that. In this list, there's some overlap, there's some cross-categorization, there's some redundancy. So I prefer to think of these as examples rather than as a definitive framework, although I suspect that they think of this as a definitive framework. But as I say to them, once they get out there onto the web and see what's out there, they'll revise this list. Yeah, we plan much of the NoTips conference using Skype. Yes, indeed. And in the same way for the R-Media sites, we used Skype, and we used Instant Messenger, and we used the Wiki, and of course, email in order to do planning for that. And that, you know, it's a funny thing. I learn online all the time, and I never go to these learning management systems anymore. I use all this whole range of tools, and that's how I learn. So, it's 9:10, which gives me about 20 minutes, but the rest of this stuff now is going to be stuff you know. And this is the whole point. People already know this stuff. They don't need to learn new things in order to learn how to learn online. So, here are the issues that I was just summarizing with e-learning framework. Most of these services already exist on the World Wide Web. The rest of them are definitely in development. And there is some cross-categorization. As I see in this slide here, it's as though the functions of a centralized system have simply been transferred to the distributed environment. But when they think about it, when they get into the practice of actually designing these systems, I think that there will be a rationalization of that list. Certainly in my own work, there has been. So, what sort of systems are there? Look at content authoring and delivery. Content authoring systems on the web. All kinds of places where you can send students to author content using Blogger, for example, or WordPress, or the one we saw earlier, LiveJournal. These are all places where students can create their own web blogs. Or people can use Access, Use, Install their own content management system. Here are some systems. Drupal, which is what we use to build our media. PostNuke, Clone, Scoop. There are many, this is just a short list, content management systems out there. Now, these systems that I've listed here, first of all of these are free. You do not pay for any of these. Secondly, all of these are open source, which means that they have a large development community. So that they're continually evolving, and they've become very sophisticated. Francis says we use Moodle. Yes, Moodle fits right into that list. People talking about Moodle as being an online learning management system. From where I sit, Moodle is mostly a content management system. It fits right in there with Drupal, PostNuke, Clone, Zope, and the rest. Where Moodle's for, Moodle is for the Lord. And the other thing is, there's a snap to install. I installed a copy of Drupal on my own web server the other day. It quite literally took me less than 5 minutes to go from finding the software online to starting it up and being inside my now running Drupal site. What about more complicated content? How about audio? I use a program called Audacity. Audacity is free software. I have a copy on my laptop here. It runs beautifully. I've created a whole bunch of audio recordings with that, including the talk that I gave in Vancouver just this past week. Let's see if this will work. It should work. Why wouldn't it work? This website here is the location where you can find all of the audio files that I've recorded over the last year. I'm a bit behind in putting them up on the site, but there's 20 or 30 audio recordings of various talks there. All of those I recorded with Audacity. Total cost of recording? A few dollars, because I got a microphone with batteries and I decided to get new batteries. But other than that, free. Audio blogs is a place where phone in your audio post. You just call up your blog and leave a message, and it shows up as an audio post on your blog. Podcasting is a whole story in itself, but if you look at a website, I believe it's podcasting.org, or it might be podcasting.com. They probably both exist now. You can find out about podcasting. That's a way of not only creating audio files, but distributing them so that the rest of the world can hear. Digital imagery, well, I love my digital camera, the video cameras, you have the little quick cams. There are out there video blogs, if you look at videoblogs.com. And then Flickr, which I mentioned earlier, is a place where you can upload and store your photographs. And then Our Media, which I just mentioned, is just like Flickr, except it's for multimedia content. Songs, audio recordings, videos, things like that. yeah, Kate, and I wish I could go into much more detail in audio blogs. But if you just Google audio blogs, or just Google podcasting, you'll find a wealth of knowledge very quickly. And that's the way it works, right? That's learning in a distributed environment. Now you have questions, now you go looking for it, and the content that you need is out there on the web. Organizing, syndicating, sequencing, delivery, these are biggies for education, aren't they? But there's a whole range of standards or common languages designed specifically to make this possible. For example, RSS and ADAM are two types of content syndication format. RSS stands for Rich Site Summary, or some people say Really Simple Syndication. Oh, okay, Jeff, we'll see you later. OPML is open processor markup language, which is a really obscure name because all an OPML file is a list of RSS files, nothing more. FOF stands for Friend of a Friend. That's a type of content format that you use to describe yourself. It has fields for your name, for your address. It even has one for nearest airport, so that if you have a collection of FOF files, you can create a map with little pins where all the people are based on their airport as defined in their FOF file. DC, Dublin Core, which is basic bibliographic metadata, and of course, learning object metadata, which describes educational resources. All of these are languages that are used in order to organize and distribute online content. I've seen a metro control folks somewhere. Yes, you probably have, because one of the fields in a phone file is city. What city do you live in? So there's a program out there that just goes out and harvests or retrieves phone files and then groups them according to city. And so you would have a list of all the people with phone file living in a given city. You see, that's the power of these kind of languages. It greatly increases your ability to locate and organize materials, which is the real challenge. I've mentioned aggregators such as NewsGator or Bloglines. Go to bloglines.com. And if you want to read my newsletter without getting it in your email, go to bloglines.com, create an account, and then click on the little tab that says add, and then add this, the feed that I've just typed here on the screen. Now what that will do is Bloglines will now, on a regular basis, about once an hour, it'll look into this on my website, look for new content, and if there is new content, it'll bring it back and display it for you. This is the distributed web, right? Does that have something to do with GPS addresses put into a mapping system? In FOTH, there is also a field that allows you to put in your longitude and latitude, and you can also put that into a mapping system. I don't see any lines on the screen. I just typed something on the screen. Are people not seeing it? Maybe I have to move that little box. There it is. Oh, I see. Good. There are other services out there on the web that what they do is they retrieve thousands, millions of these RSS and ATOM files. That's called harvesting or aggregating. In Technorati and BlogDex and PubSub, if you just type any of these names, .com, you'll go to their site. Excuse me. And what they do is they bring in all this data from all over the world, and then they organize it in different ways. PubSub, for example, I use PubSub. I've created what's called a PubSub feed, and what it does is it scans all the 4 million blogs out there, and the feed that I define looks for references to me, because I'm very egotistical. And so I can find out within minutes of it being written what has been written about me pretty well anywhere in the world. And then there's more coming, the semantic social network. If you do a search for semantic social network, then you will find a paper that I wrote that talks about how all of these standards can be combined to create something very powerful. And you give me a mention. Thank you, Kate. I'll watch for you on PubSub. Okay. We talked about DRM and authentication earlier. A lot of work being done in the field of online learning about that. But there's a lot being done outside online learning. Most of the work that we've seen so far has been centralized, or at the very least, federated. We may have heard of Passport or Liberty or even Shibboleth, which is a federated system. I won't define federated, I just don't have time in this, but it's sort of like centralized, but not quite. It's kind of like centralized, but it's like compassionate centralization. Yeah, that's what it is. Just kidding. But there are in development now distributed forms of digital rights management. Creative Commons, which you may have heard of, is the classic sort of distributed digital rights content. Yeah. And there are distributed identification management systems. These are very new. SXID, which is pronounced SKIP, or LID, what does that stand for? Lightweight Identity. These are systems, they're not mainstream yet, you can't use them yet, but they're coming online. And my argument is our educational software should be using these internet-wide services rather than a special service that's designed specifically for online learning. And then we're almost at the end of my slides here. some more services. I mentioned Skype a bit earlier. There are some others, network education, where video conferencing. It was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I did a video conference with some people in British Columbia. And on my end, all I had was America Online Instant Messenger and a webcam. And then they showed it up on a big screen in their room. It was for Janet McCracken's class at Simon Fraser University. Oh, it's great. I didn't need anything fancy, but I did need a webcam, of course. You're not going to get video conferencing without a camera. But really, I didn't do anything special to make this work. I just started it up, and for the most part, it just ran. Instant Messenger, which I've mentioned earlier, all of these forms, all of these distributed modes of communication, these are the sorts of things that our educational software and our online courses should be explicitly using. I think that was the last slide. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot collaboration. And really, my approach to collaboration in one word, wikis. I like wikis. Oh, three more. Oh, I guess I got excited. Oh, that's right. There's the closing slide. The closing slide doesn't really count. So, the upshot. E-learning so far has been grounded in centralized systems. But these centralized systems, well, on the one hand, as I say, they're like a dysfunctional crutch. But on the other hand, too, they're on the way out. Now, it doesn't mean the companies will wither up and die necessarily. But the closed down, locked in system that you've become accustomed to so far is being increasingly challenged by a wider range of critics that are looking at the wide array of services out there on the web. Blogs, wikis, Skype, instant messaging, all of the rest. And they're saying, why can't we use these things? Why can't we talk to each other? Why can't I have content that I can use in Blackboard and WebCT? These kind of questions are being asked. I ran a thing by Alan Levine from Maricopa in my newsletter today. He's sitting there looking at these large federated search systems. That's kind of like big boxes with limited talking ability to each other. He scratches his head and he says, why don't we use Google? And why don't we use Google? Google actually works pretty well. There's so much out there. But the important thing is that you have to leave the learning management system environment behind. You have to get outside of your online class and get out there and experience the web. And by experience the web, I mean go out there and live it. Go play backgammon on Yahoo. Go write a blog on cats or beekeeping. Get you and your friends, a few of your friends, to install Skype and call each other on Skype. Use ICQ or AOL Instant Messaging to collaborate on a project. Set up a wiki or go to a place called wikipedia.org and add some content to the world's largest encyclopedia. Live the web, because that's how you'll understand how limiting these big box learning management systems are. And once you do that, you'll see, as the slide says, it's a very different world online, where you are no longer in control, but where, as it turns out, that's a good thing. And that's my talk. And we still have some time for questions or comments, I think. And I'll surrender the microphone, yes.
Hi there, Stephen. This is Kate in the UK.
Kate.
Go ahead, Kate. Okay, can you hear me? Okay. Great. Stephen, I'm interested in your e-learning framework slides and in picking into your services available. I'm an online training myself. I was wondering, out of those grids, whether you personally have an opinion about how many of those you would say were necessary for student comfort in learning. or do you leave the whole gamut of those open to the students that you have, or whether you narrow those down to the ones you feel most useful?
Well, that's a great question. A nasty one. it really depends on your approach to learning. Because another one of these big divisions, I didn't talk about this talk at all, is the distinction between formal and informal learning. And if you read the sorts of things that I write about, you'll find that I am a very large advocate of informal learning. I cite Jay Cross very frequently. He says 90% of all learning is informal. And so my interest is generally directed toward informal learning. And my feeling is that even our formal learning, public school, kindergarten to grade 12 classrooms, universities, should be moving toward more informal learning because it's more student-centered, it's more student-directed, and a push toward informal learning, especially in their early years, is tantamount to teaching students how to learn as opposed to simply what to learn. Now, a lot of these boxes are intended to support formal learning. If we look at them here, we've got things like marking, grading, or competency, reporting, tracking, learning flow. These are all, mechanisms of control rather than mechanisms of learning. And to the extent that they support control rather than learning, my desire is to see us use less of them rather than more of them. Now, of course, I've heard on numerous occasions the rejoinder that, well, students, especially young students, need this control, they need this guidance, they need to be evaluated, they need to be marked, they need to be graded. And to a certain degree, that's true. But I think not to the degree that we do it today. I think that we do much more controlling, much more grading, much more guiding than is necessary. So the things that I favor tend to be on the other slide, the things that support things like mapping or harvesting or search, identifying, messaging. These are the core of learning in my mind. These are the things that allow students to identify, locate, retrieve, and organize resources, and then more importantly, use these resources, organize, reorganize, remix, repurpose these resources to create something of their own. And in creating these things of their own, to converse with other students, to take what is on the web and to use it as a vocabulary in which they can express themselves. Julia says writing is scarily bad. Well, yeah, but how much writing do they do? How much real writing to real people in real environments? I think that we'll find that as time goes by and as students communicate with each other more and more, that writing will become less bad. Well, it might evolve, so we still call it bad, but they'll become more communicative.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Is there any other questions before we wrap up, or are we ready to go?
Well, I'm seeing a question about BitTorrents. BitTorrents is a nifty little idea. What it is a mechanism that increases the speed of downloads by sharing the load. Remember I talked about bandwidth requirements on centralized systems? What BitTorrents does is that it alleviates that. Instead of having 100 people all trying to get the same file from one server, the first person gets the file from the server, but then shares the file that they've gotten from the server with the second person, who shares it with the third, and so on. And so from a single download stream, you're actually providing the content to a number of people. It's a neat idea. You need making a client on your own computer to make it work. So I haven't used it a whole lot, but it's very popular and very widespread. As Julia says, a fan-out system, exactly.
Well, Stephen, I thank you very much for your presentation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I'm sure everyone else did. And I just want to take this opportunity to remind everybody that Nancy will be presenting in half an hour, so if you have time, come in at 1800 Pacific Standard Time for our next presentation, which is Building the Practice of Online Facilitation with our wonderful Nancy. And we do appreciate all of your time and your insights, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Stephen Downs speaking online at the NoTips Conference sometime in February 2005. This is Stephen Downs signing off.